Hello, Bold Traveller, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me sunny side up, as instead we celebrate the best of the worst of the best in one of our episodes where we go back to a previous selection of episodes from the vaults and see if we can find the best examples of what we have discussed. And why are we doing that? Well, let's face it, it's not like 2022 has been any better than the previous 6 years. Does the world turning to shit correspond with me and Barry starting this podcast? Yes. Is causation the same as correlation? No. But in this case, probably. All I'm saying is that the first podcast I was ever involved in was called the Newcastle Natter, and it corresponded very much with Mike Ashley taking over Newcastle United and driving that football club into the ground. And where is it now? Owned by Bond villains. If you want to evade the climate catastrophe, economic Ragnarok, and Russia pulling out of the bag in Ukraine, best to assassinate me and my co-host, pronto. And here he is, with a red target drawn on his head by yours truly. It's your favourite sacrificial victim and mine, Barry McStay.
How did I get scapegoated into this?
Collective cabinet responsibility.
Oh, yeah,
mate.
Okay. The captain and the entire crew and all the passengers should go down with his ship.
Correct. We all go down together.
Yeah. We haven't done one of these for a little while. One of our retrospective episodes where we go back, look at a past bunch of episodes, in this case, episodes 86 to 90, and look at the best of those topics instead of the worst of. And those topics were World's Worst Fictional Child, World's Worst Death Scene, World's Worst Cult. They could kind of go together, those two.
Yes, they
world's
could.
World's Worst President, and World's Worst Fan Fiction. So shall we jump right in with fictional children?
Let's jump in with the fictional children. This was with Molly Kerr-Horn,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Literary agent Molly Kerr-Horn. And our winner of that episode was the child prodigy character Adhemar from the Belgian comic strip The Adventures of Nero, which I believe was your suggestion. He was just one of those like Stewie Griffin but without the charm type kids. Always pulling people up on stuff, and had posters of Einstein on his wall, and a little bit too clever by
half. Yes, I think his... Exactly, it felt like his catchphrase was, I think you'll find.
Yeah. Can I tell you my favourite fictional child, because it is the correct answer?
Go for
Matilda
it.
Matilda Wormwood.
Oh, that's going to be hard to counter. Yeah.
Matilda was and still is basically one of my favourite books, Matilda by Roald Dahl.
Yes.
And one of the last books he wrote, 1988, children's novel. And she's a 6.5-year-old girl who has a big passion for reading. And as that nerdy child who read voraciously and was much more into it than playing sports, she very much was my kind of kid. We would have been friends, but sat on opposite sides of the room, not talking to each other during our play dates, just engrossed in... Well, I'd have been reading Enid Blyton, Famous Five and Secret Seven books, and she would be reading all these books. Matilda has read all of these by the age of about 4, or when she turns 4. Secret Garden, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Great Expectations, Jane Eyre, Pride and Prejudice, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Kim by Rudyard Kipling, The Invisible Man, The Old Man and the Sea, The Sound and the Fury by Faulkner, Grapes of Wrath, Brighton Rock by Graham Greene, Animal Farm, Moby Dick, Ivanhoe, The Wind and the Willows. Just a child prodigy.
Are those all listed in Matilda? Because it's been, full disclosure, it's been a while since I've read Matilda. Obviously, it has not been a while since I listened to the soundtrack by Tim Minchin and Dennis Kelly and cried openly on public transport.
Yes, if anyone hasn't seen the musical of Matilda, it is great. My husband and I, as you will know, walked down the aisle to When I Grow Up from that musical.
God, you did. That was a tricky watch. Yeah. For reasons of soundtrack. Sorry, I had to phrase that correctly, but just the entire aesthetic was just like, guys, come on, it's the start of the wedding.
already dragged people to into introspection, a dangerous level of introspection.
Well, yes, it wasn't welcome to Barry and Mikey's wedding, it was welcome to Barry and Mikey's emotional manipulation.
Yeah. Obviously, the thing about Matilda, if people don't know the book, she's, you know, not really cared for by her family, and she's terrorized by Miss Trunchbull, who's the awful headmistress at her school, and Miss Honey, who's her teacher, is the one who takes particular interest in her and helps encourage her intelligence and stuff like that. And she, Matilda, develops psychokinetic powers by discovering she can tip over a glass of water containing a live newt onto Miss Trunchbull, and she can, you know, she practices by levitating a cigar, and she gets spoiler. Miss Trunchbull is Miss Honey's guardian and aunt, who has taken on her care of Miss Honey after her father Magnus's unexpected death. And Matilda makes a piece of chalk write on a blackboard, make it seem like it's the ghost of Magnus, threatening to punish Miss Trunchbull if she doesn't leave her inheritance to Miss Honey. And she disappears. It's quite dark.
I mean, so many of Roald Dahl's stories are quite dark, and obviously sometimes Roald Dahl, as we've discussed before on the podcast, can be a little bit problematic. But I think what's so good about Matilda is that it's not just darkness for darkness's sake to freak the children out or be weird at them or be just, you know, like The Twits is a very entertaining book, but it's basically just two disgusting people being disgusting. Whereas this is, it's Roald Dahl at the peak of his powers is going, I'm not going to sugarcoat the world for you children. Some people can be horrible, really horrible. And it's the attempt to crush the inquisitive spirit of a little girl like that is so heartbreaking. Because even in the, you know, when I went to go see the musical at Stratford-upon-Avon, and it was Paul Kay, a.k.a. Dennis Pennis, a.k.a. the Red Priest, I think, from Game of Thrones, who was incredible as Mr. Wormwood. Mm. And I don't name the actor who played his wife, but she was brilliant as well. And they were incredibly funny and brilliant performers, but I really hated them for the way they treated Matilda. So, job done.
Yeah, Matilda manages to be one of those kids who is smart and intelligent without being annoying about it, and actually, particularly for anyone who, like me, was a bookworm and sort of feels that affinity to her, seeing her like develop these magic powers and be able to use them to express her, they sort of come out a bit like it's like a little Hulk thing. It comes out when she's particularly enraged or sees an injustice taking place. I was furious as a child that I couldn't knock over a glass of water with my mind. So I thought, I'm just like Matilda. Why can't I do this?
What, and so you were forced to use your hands?
And they do, those powers do wear off in the book. She obviously, the sort of the book suggests she doesn't need them anymore when, you know, she eventually gets put into the right class and Miss Honey gets her inheritance, and Miss Honey takes over her guardianship of Matilda as well because her parents are awful.
I was just thinking, I think the most heartbreaking bit is the whole, which, and I don't know whether they emphasize it more in the musical, the story which is weaved about the acrobat and the acrobat's daughter.
Miss Honey turns out to be.
That's particularly heartbreaking.
So I love Matilda. And the other thing I like about this is one of the most famous scenes in the book, in the musical. There's a new movie coming out with Emma Thompson as Miss Trunchbull shortly.
And indeed, former guest on the show, Sindhu V, as the librarian.
Yes. So keep an eye out for that. I think it's coming up towards Christmas this year. It'll be out. One of the most famous scenes is when a kid, a particularly large kid, and I have to say, Roald Dahl isn't always great about fat people and fat children, but fat child in this, Bruce Bogtrotter, steals a bit of Miss Trunchbull's cake, chocolate cake, or at least is accused of doing that. And so Miss Trunchbull sits him down and makes him eat the entire cake. And instead of something, you know, something terrible happening to him as a result, he manages to heroically eat the entire cake. And the thing I really enjoy about that scene is Roald Dahl released a sort of a book of revolting recipes, and one of the recipes is Bruce Bogtrotter's cake. So you can make
tremendous. I particularly like the way various Trunchbulls I have seen have pronounced the name Bogtrotter.
it's a very Dalian name.
When he's on his game, and not being, you know, racist, yeah. Roald Dahl is a great namer of characters. Yeah. I would wager on his day, he's up there with Charles Dickens and Terry Pratchett as a great namer.
Yeah, he did have his off days. I think we mentioned in the episode with Molly Kirkhorn that he had a few goes at the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory kids' names, and there were early drafts of the book where there were, you know, 8 or 10 children going into the factory, and rejected names include Herpes Trout and Miranda Grope.
I don't mind Herpes Trout as much as others. I think, I mean, obviously...
Little herpes.
Little herpes.
And syphilis and chlamydia, well, I mean, the listen, twins.
Yeah. And gonorrhea, who just wants to be friends with everybody.
So yeah, Matilda is evidently, obviously, the best fictional child by one of the best children's authors.
A extremely strong argument. I briefly wanted to mention George from George's Marvelous Medicine, because that was one that really entertained me.
That's another good recipe.
I found, yes, very much so. In 2020, a team of British researchers performed a toxicological investigation into the potion and all 34 of its ingredients. They reported in the British Medical Journal, no less, that if ingested, George's Marvelous Medicine would not make your grandmother grow by several factors. Instead, it would cause vomiting, kidney injury, convulsions, and other severe health problems, including the most likely clinical outcome, death. The overall outcome for grandma would be a fatal, catastrophic, physiological collapse.
I think I could have told you that.
Yes.
I'm not a medical doctor.
Yes. I also have an enormous amount of love for both Bernard and the monster. Are they the same person? From Not Now Bernard. Yeah. I particularly love the copy that I've got. Like, obviously, we've got more than one copy in this household. That I think it's got quotes from Frank Cotterill Boyce, who's a wonderful author, and Adam Buxton, basically going, "This is the greatest work of art in all of Western civilization." Yeah. But for my choice, I've sort of gone for sort of an ensemble, maybe bring it down to one individual. I looked at Bugsy Malone, who I think is a great fictional child. So Bugsy Malone premiered where, Barry, in 1976?
Was it in Ireland?
Nope. It was at the Cannes Film Festival, great, where it competed for the Palme d'Or.
Yeah, well, Alan Parker, who directed, is a very fine film director.
Yeah, well, yeah, I didn't realise this. Like, Bugsy Malone was, I think, his first movie, but his CV is ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. He did Fame, he did the movie version of Evita, he directed The Commitments, yeah.
Yeah, and Mississippi Burning, Midnight Express, Angela's Ashes. I mean, what a CV. The genesis of it was that him and his kids used to go to a cottage in Derbyshire at the weekends, and to sort of stop the car journey being so boring, he started telling them stories of a gangster called Bugsy Malone, and the kids would ask him questions and he'd make up answers. And his eldest son basically said to him, "Dad, why can't the heroes in this be children?" And he basically went, "That's a good idea." And here we are. I love some of the casting of it. So Scott Baio played Bugsy. He didn't really want to be in the film. He said, "I had to quit the business because I didn't like driving into Manhattan, spoken like a true world-weary child star." And he said, "The long and short of it was, I wanted to play with my friends after school, and it happened to be raining that day, so I went to the city to meet Alan Parker." I read it. I barely read it. I didn't even want to be there. He was just this weird guy with long hair, and I didn't know who he was. So I sort of read the script, threw it at him, and walked out the door. And that was it. I'd gotten the part before I got home.
Nice. Yeah. I do have to point out Scott Baio is not a particularly nice person.
He's now quite Trumpy?
Very Trumpy. Once described President Obama as being either dumb, a Muslim, or a Muslim sympathizer, and I don't think he's dumb. And he's retweeted Sandy Hook conspiracy theory memes and has had sexual misconduct and verbal abuse and physical assault accusations thrown at him. And he's a big fan of Trump and so on. So not the sort of person I would be spending my time with as an adult. But as a child, no, well, he's not absolutely.
Yeah, listen, he's not the only person from the cast with a checkered past. Jodie Foster, complicit in the assassination attempt on a American president. Allegedly. My other favourite piece of casting was when Parker tried to find the casting for Fat Sam, he visited a Brooklyn classroom asking for the naughtiest boy in the class. And apparently all the students pointed at John Cassisi and went, him. He was like, you got the role, kid.
That's so good.
Cassisi retired from acting in 1982, became involved in construction work, and from 2012 to 2014, he served as director of global construction for Citigroup. In 2015, he pled guilty to a bribery scheme and was sentenced to 2 to 6 years in prison plus $500,000 of forfeiture.
Oh, the Bugsy Malone curse.
Yeah, Fat Sam's Grand Slam.
Wow. That's not great.
It's not great. Two last things. How many cream pies do you think were thrown during the making of the movie?
I don't know. A couple of thousand.
A thousand. Nice. Yeah, bang on.
I just keep thinking that must have been the most fun. The end fight before they all start singing just must have been the best time ever.
It must have been. It was slightly tricky to pull off in cameras, would have you believe. They couldn't get the splurge guns to work, so the guns had to fire ping pong balls. And if you watch it again, there's pretty much a sharp cut between every firing and every splurging. Mm. So the splurging was done either manually or via another mechanism which didn't look as good as a pretend Tommy gun. But nevertheless, a lot of fun. And the final thing I tell you about, there was a rivalry between the British and American kids on the set that included the British dance girls blocking the halls in Pinewood Studios to American dance girls. And if they didn't give the password, they would spray them with a fire extinguisher. The girls going method.
Yeah, absolutely. This whole argument that video games and movies don't influence the behaviour of children, they're literally taking the splurge guns off the walls of the studio. Using them in real life. Bonnie Langford was in it at that age as well, wasn't she?
She was one of the
dancers, young dancers in it. That's cool. Yeah, Bugsy Malone is an excellent shout as well.
It is, but it's not as good as Matilda, is it?
Matilda doesn't have magic powers, does he?
No.
She could levitate splurge and throw it across the room. Come on now, the phrase levitate splurge.
I'm not going to Google it if you promise not to.
The next episode we did was the world's worst death scene with Matt Hyten, and our winner of that was Robert Coates, who was an English eccentric and enthusiastic amateur actor who would often perform in Shakespearean shows and liked repeating the death scenes. He sort of thought they went down terribly well and would do them over and over again multiple times per performance sometimes. And he sort of became the draw became Coates, but not for the reason he hoped it would be in terms of selling tickets. Where have you gone for the world's best death scene then?
So I've got a couple of choices. Rather infamously in our family, where my father-in-law is Italian, I have only seen one out of the three Godfather movies, as indeed has my wife. Admittedly, you only really need to see two of them. And I'm not a huge Marlon Brando fan. Like, clearly the man is very, very good, but I'm not, I don't know, for some reason I'm not drawn to him the way I'm drawn to other actors. But the final scene of The Godfather, where Vito Corleone dies in amongst the... Sorry, spoiler alert, you've seen The Godfather, right?
Years ago, so I don't remember any of the details.
So it's him as an old man playing with his grandson in a tomato... to say tomato plantation, which sounds a lot grimmer than it's meant to.
In a tomateria.
Yes, precisely. And he's playing around with him, and then he gets a piece of orange peel, sticks it in his mouth, having drawn some fangs on it, and pretends to be a monster. And then he exerts himself too much doing that, and he has a heart attack, and he keels over and dies. And there's just the little kid sort of wondering what's going on in his grandpa playing. And it's such a incredible piece of acting.
Oranges are not the only
because there's the classic.
So Sorry. I had to say it to get it out of my system. Yes, it's a very moving scene. I remember it now vividly.
Yes, it is.
They're all the deaths are foreshadowed with oranges in The Godfather, aren't they? Or a lot of them are. Anyone near oranges is about to be a death.
Oh, is that the equivalent of the Star Trek red shirts?
Yes. I'm pretty sure that's a thing, yeah. Whenever there's oranges about to be anywhere. Yeah, when the Godfather gets shot, he's buying oranges, and obviously Vito's peeling one at the end. They just tend to be around.
Oh, that's a nice little motif. Yeah. But I don't know how to describe it. Because obviously, particularly in the modern world, we just don't encounter death much at all. It is medicalized and sterilized. And there's a lot of very good and moving writing about, well, we need to stop making it such a taboo and deal with the fact that it's going to happen to us all. And we should go and sort of watch it vicariously.
Particularly at the end of a film like that, where death is sort of lurking in the air for all of them. And then he gets to old age and you sort of see a softer side of that character. And then it comes for him.
You do. And it's... what's really nice is it's not a... You know, there's quite an interesting history of monsters like Stalin and Pol Pot who got to die in their own bed. And this is... It's an even nicer death than that, in a way, because it's outside in the sunshine playing with your grandson. And there's... I read a bit about the sort of the film studies analysis of it, saying that it's him masquerading at being a monster with the vampire teeth, having previously been an actual monster. And he's there watering the plants with a water gun, so it's his power is denuded. Yeah. And then there's the whole thing about him passing on the power to Michael, but there's also the grandson there and that generational thing. But it's also the thing is... Sometimes Brando could be, you know, a bit of a big old cumbersome barrel-chested guy, and dying on stage or on screen is about as hard as being drunk. Yeah. I think it's very hard to do well. And it's just utterly believable in that way that it should look a bit uncomfortable and messy.
Yes. It's like fights on screen. The thing I enjoyed most about the Daniel Craig era of Bond, particularly the first sort of couple of them, particularly Casino Royale, is just how messy they made a lot of the fighting look.
Yeah. Well, which if you go back and watch Sean Connery's Bonds, the first two or three, the fights in that are horrible. Yeah. Like as in a good way. It's not all nice, neat, choreographed moves.
It's life or death. Desperation.
It is life or death. But that's not my choice, as brilliant as it is, because I went for another life or death.
Mainly death.
Well, obviously life or death. Maybe death. A death and death scene. Or is it? Oh, that makes it sound like I'm going to go for Ming the Merciless, and I'm not, even though that just occurred to me, and that's a banger of a death as well.
Or Moriarty at the end of season two of Sherlock.
Is literally my choice.
Is it?
Well, not... the Andrew Scott Moriarty. I'm going back to the original source of the final problem.
I see. Very good. Yes.
Yes. Which is the short story by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, in which Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes grapple on the edge of the Reichenbach Falls and fall to apparently their mutual death, but not... not because of some excellent plot twisting by Conan Doyle, but because there was such an outcry amongst Holmes fans that he was forced to bring them back.
Reichenbach Falls are a real place if people aren't aware of them. They're quite near Davos, where they have that international financial summit every year, I think.
That sounds about right. They're in Switzerland, in a nearest habitation is called Meiringen, and it's got a little plaque there written in several languages, sort of commemorating the thing that didn't happen there. Yeah, the result of the death, so there's the Strand magazine, which I believe is where Doyle published some of the stories. It barely survived the resulting rush of cancellations, and there are possibly erroneous stories about young men throughout London wearing black mourning crepes on their hats or around their arms for the month of Holmes's death.
I quite like the idea that he'd been on a Swiss holiday, Conan Doyle, and he was being shown the falls. Did you see the thing about it? Yes, go on.
He was being shown the falls by Sir Henry Lunn, the founder of Lunn Poly, which any British or, I assume, Irish person brought up in the 80s and 90s will know as one of the most famous travel agents on the high street. Yeah. I love it when you go back and go, oh, there's the origin story of that name on the high street that I've never thought about. And in fact, so Sir Henry's grandson recalls, my grandfather said, push him over the Reichenbach Falls, and Conan Doyle hadn't heard of them, so he showed them to him. Yeah. So without a travel agent, Arthur Conan Doyle wouldn't have written one of Sherlock Holmes's most infamous scenes.
And they've eroded as well, so the path, the falls don't look now like they did 130 years ago, because the path used to be right at the edge of the falls, which I think would probably will have been where the fight was, but it's become unsafe and the falls have sort of pushed back further into the gorge now. But yeah, it is. It's a very good place for a great grapple between two brilliant minds. That's a very good shout. Very good shout.
Thank you.
Let me introduce you to a pioneering screen death. The first complete digital composite shot in Hollywood history. One of the death scenes that I think would make the most impression on people of our generation, Ben. It is the rapid aging and decaying of Julian Glover's character Walter Donovan in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
He chose poorly.
Correct.
You have chosen wisely.
I think so. It is just screen magic, particularly seeing it for the first time. It is remarkable. It is the first time that technique had been fully used. Glover was filmed in lots of different stages of makeup, and they would speed up the thing and they'd meld them all together. And they also used some shots of puppet heads for some of the latter stages of it when he turns into the skeleton's one, and then put it all back into the film in one cohesive take. And it's just a remarkable piece of filmmaking. To make it happen. I just read a little bit more about, and obviously the whole scene in that room with you chose poorly and you chose wisely and Elsa and Indy and the night and all of those things. It's a suitably grand and tense and reverent and shocking finale to the film. A friend of the show, Joel Morris, recently tweeted a link to a whole trove of Last Crusade trivia, including some stuff about the rewrites that happened on the script, because they developed the script at length. And Tom Stoppard, the great English playwright, wrote quite a lot of the dialogue under his pseudonym Barry Watson, which I quite like, because it took a lot of development. I mean, in early drafts, Donovan wasn't called Donovan; he was called Chandler.
And
he wasn't in it. He was like an off-screen character. Then he was brought into the film, but he wasn't the main villain. He was killed much earlier in it during the tank sequence. And instead, I think Vogel, who's the Nazi commanding officer who does die in the tank sequence in the completed film, he sort of is the one who dies later on. And then Elsa ends up shooting Henry, and she's the one who drinks from the cup. So she's the big villain of the piece.
And Elsa's the blonde, I was just going to say the blonde Nazi, narrow it down, Ben.
She's the other archaeologist, yes.
Who sort of beds Harrison Ford and then does the bait and switch on
him. Yes, sleeps with Harrison Ford and with his father and does that great scene where you think she's been caught by the Nazis and actually, no, she's betraying him. And no, she's a Nazi herself. And there's a lot of intrigue with her character, but they give her that little redemption where she gives the cup to Donovan, which kills him, but she wants to escape with, and then her own greed leads to her demise. It's a much more satisfying arc than
it is. She's a great character, because it's like we've talked about on this show, it's very easy to make Worst Foot Forward about here's all the dumb things men have done ever, because men are always super dumb, and yes, we are. But it's good when you meet a woman who either heroically fails or is a satisfying villain.
Yeah.
And she's quite an underrated one, I think.
She really is. I think, I don't know if this is true, but I get the impression the inspiration for her character came from the idea of, came from Leni Riefenstahl. Because when they sort of began to go back to Nazis as the villains when they were developing the piece, there was a draft where Leni Riefenstahl was in the scenes in Berlin when they're burning the books and so on. I also should be saying, Julian Glover's actual real-life wife, Isla Blair, appears in the movie as... Mrs. Donovan, when she comes in and says, "Oh, Walter, you're neglecting our guests." Isla Blair is credited in the credits as Mrs. Glover, as Mrs. Donovan. And if you listen very carefully when she opens the door to come in, there's like a party happening outside of the room and you can hear some piano music. The piano music, if you turn it right up, is a sort of a lounge version of the Imperial March from Star Wars.
Oh, yes, please. I love all those little Easter eggs.
There's another little Easter egg you wouldn't be aware of. The scene where Indy and Henry are on the German Zeppelin and they're sort of having a little conversation at one of the tables. They are not wearing any trousers below the camera. It was apparently really hot on set and Sean Connery decided to take his slacks off while they were shooting the scene because it was only from, you know, the tabletop up. And Harrison Ford thought, oh, well, if Sean Connery's doing it, I'll do it as well. Spielberg was also afraid the movie would remind people of Monty Python. When they'd hit on the Holy Grail as the idea, Spielberg apparently was said, of course I was worried people would hear Holy Grail and would immediately think about a white rabbit attacking Monty Python. My first reaction was to say, everybody run away, run away. And do you want to hear some of the early drafts of the screenplay, some of the ideas they had?
Go on.
Before the, one of the ideas Spielberg and George Lucas threw around was the idea of Indy facing it off against a ghost in Scotland. And the search would be for the Fountain of Youth. The story was going to be called Indiana Jones and the Monkey King. Chris Columbus.
That's too close to a number of goon shows.
Chris Columbus, the screenwriter, came in and had a go at bashing out this idea. The character of the ghost was the late Baron Seamus Seagrove III. But they replaced the Fountain of Youth with the Peaches of Immortality, which is a Chinese mythological construct.
No, I was mixing that up with the... Is it the Salmon of Truth that you've talked about from Irish
folklore?
The Salmon of Knowledge, excuse me.
There's a lot of mythological food. And Columbus's first draft also included a 200-year-old pygmy. There was a chess game where the Monkey King would challenge Indy to a game of chess but use real people as pieces, which is quite a cool image. Mm-hmm. Columbus was replaced as screenwriter by Menno Meges, who also wrote The Color Purple. And he introduced the Holy Grail idea and Henry Jones Sr. and so on. But his script concluded with Indy's dad ascending into heaven upon finding the Grail, and Indy marrying a former nun named Chantal.
How can you be so right and so wrong all at the same time? I would love to see less so Henry Jones Sr. and more Sean Connery playing him ascending to heaven, going straight up to God and going, "You're in my seat."
Yes. One note from the things Joel Morris was retweeting recently, some of Tom Stoppard's dialogue writing is just so on point and so well observed. There's a moment in the script where they're escaping the Zeppelin and they get into a biplane attached to the Zeppelin. They fly away. And in the original draft, Henry Jones Sr. says, "Can you really fly a plane?" And Indy says, "Let's find out together." In Stoppard's draft, Henry goes on a little more of a journey in those two lines because he goes, "I didn't know you could fly a plane." And Indy goes, "Fly, yes. Land, no." So instead of not knowing, he's relieved by the initial idea that Indy seems to be able to fly a plane. And it's just those little like dialogue tweaks by a master craftsman like Tom Stoppard, which just add the humour, and because he realises the central relationship between Indy and his dad is going to carry the entire film, and he tries to pump up the comedic relief you get between family members in it.
Of course. I mean, like, literally talk about the journey where that's four words and you can literally see the almost like a four act arc in those four words as it goes up and down and up and down.
It's great. But that's a little bit about the whole film, but I think the death of Walter Donovan made a big impression of me as a kid and as a pioneering piece of CGI work as well. I thought I'd mention that one.
It's It's remarkable because it's almost like they looked at the, I forget the name of the actor, but the death of the exploding Nazi in Raiders and went, how can we see that and
yes,
raise it?
Exactly. So Walter Donovan versus Holmes and Moriarty over the Mott Reichenbach Falls. I mean, it's iconic. Both of them are pretty iconic.
I mean, I would suggest that mine has got more cultural capital. It's had an extra 100 years to build
yes,
it up.
Yes, I think so. And it's been recreated so many multiple times.
Yes, and I would argue, just for the absolute kicker, is if you go to the ruins at Petra, there isn't a plaque commemorating the death of Julian Glover there.
Yeah,
so.
That's very, very true. In which case, congratulations, Holmes and Moriarty. We said congratulations down there. In episode 88, we talked to Helen McCarthy about the world's worst cult, and our winner of that was the Ant Hill Kids. It's your typical 70s and 80s doomsday cult. Multiple wives, children, slavery, abuse. Led by a charismatic figure called Roche Theriot. They were a Canadian cult. I try to... You see, part of me was tempted to go, oh, like, look at a cult fandom or something like that. And what's the least offensive cult fandom that I could find? But actually, I was very determined to try and find an actual cult whose ideology is not doing too much harm.
Good luck.
Yeah, it was tricky. I found the Missionary Church of Coppamism. Now,
Is there also a doggy style church of Coppamism?
Oh, the Space Cowboys of Coppamism. They're my favourites. Coppamists have a belief that copying information is a sacred virtue, and therefore...
What, so every time you press Control C, you have to say a little prayer?
So they think all information should be freely distributed, there should be no restrictions. They oppose copyright and hiding information. Basically, all information should be freely available at all times to everybody. So they're kind of in line with the pirate movement that we talked about, the political parties recently. And the pirate political party would be, they kind of agree with a lot of this stuff. Some of their founders have been involved in online activism and the similar sort of stuff that the pirates were involved in as well. And their webpage has the following on it. They say, a religion is a belief system with rituals. The missionary Coppamist Samfundet is a religious group centered in Sweden who believe that copying and the sharing of information is the best and most beautiful that is. To have your information copied is a token of appreciation that someone thinks you have done something good. All knowledge to all. The search for knowledge is sacred. The circulation of knowledge is sacred. The act of copying is sacred. I'm a little disappointed that they then go, the act of copying is sacred. The act of copying is sacred. they hold weddings. In 2012, they held their first wedding in Belgrade in Serbia. The ceremony was conducted by a minister in a Guy Fawkes mask. A computer read out the vows.
Right.
There was a human there conducting things via some of the computer. And then at the event, the church had a declaration. We're very happy today. Love is all about sharing. A married couple shares everything with each other. Hopefully they will copy and remix some DNA cells and create a new human being. That is the spirit of copymism. Feel the love and share that information. Copy all of its holiness.
This feels like someone tried to, in fact, did create a church in order to... get out of cheating on their exams.
Yeah, it does sound a bit like that, doesn't it? Obviously, as creatives, you and I don't want our work stolen and diminishing our income in any way. But there are sort of, there's a flip side of it where people overly protect certain copyrights and they keep extending. Like, I think did they call it the Disney law or something like that, where, you know, copyrights which are supposed to last you whatever is it 75 years after the author's death are sort of being expanded and expanded by the likes of Disney, because by rights Mickey Mouse should be public domain by now, for example.
Not all of them, though. For example, Winnie the Pooh is out of copyright, which is why next year there is a Winnie the Pooh movie called Winnie the Pooh Blood and
Yes,
Honey.
I've seen it. I've seen the trailer for it. It looks amazing. So there's a bit of me is like, yeah, these guys could be a little bit tricky for me as a writer, for example. But they're not, you know, hoarding a harem, and there's not one charismatic figure saying all the women have to have sex with me and none of the men can have any sex and all the children should be our slaves. And also we've got a small arsenal of weaponry and we're holed up on top of this hill with FBI agents closing in. As cults go, getting computers to carry out the weddings and suggesting that a little bit of light digital piracy is allowed, that's all right by me. There's less death involved.
Okay, no, that's pretty friendly. That's pretty harmless. I looked at two different cults. Firstly, we're going to go back to ancient Rome. Pythagoras, famous triangle pervert, was he had pupils who were basically followers who followed some quite eccentric notions from him, and some which I guess had a lot of reasonable foundation, but at its heart, unsurprisingly, were numbers. Pythagoras was not the first and certainly not the last person to have the notion that numbers didn't just have meaning but were sacred, but he saw the number 7 as representing wisdom, 8 justice, and 10 being the most sacred number of all. 2 was also, 4, he says, had a sense of balance because 2 plus 2 equals 4. I mean, surely all even numbers, Pythagoras. And he was a big fan of things like triangular numbers, so 1, 2, 3 and 1, 2, 3, 4, where you could stack dots to make triangles.
Right.
So that was quite nice. The nature of the cult was generally not harmful, but yes, a bit weird. So they were vegetarians, which is fair enough. He believed that animals had souls and were sacred, and he indeed believed in the transmigration of souls, so the souls of the dead could return as animals. And obviously, you don't want to accidentally eat your nan when she's come back as a chicken.
No, you want to deliberately eat her. Make sure she doesn't come back.
Yeah, there's something in there about not teaching your grandma to suck eggs, but I can't quite formulate it into a joke. I'll let you do the work on that. You can have the constituent parts. They were prohibited from eating beans. You could not stir a fire with a knife, which I think is just good all-round health and safety.
Sorry. This is one of those things like these American state laws where you're like, what was the incident that provoked this particular rule being instated?
Just they're all gathered around the Pythagorean campfire.
Oh God. And Havos has been stirring the fire with a knife again.
Yes, please, the fire fork, Pavos. you could not wear rings, and you could not touch the earth.
Couldn't wear
thundered.
Rings because they weren't triangles.
Yeah.
And he couldn't thump the earth.
Yes, not when it after it had thundered.
So would walking count as thumping the earth?
Maybe.
You'd just be perfectly still.
He couldn't touch the earth. Yes. I don't know what the statute of limitations was on this, whether they had to wait for 30 seconds, a minute, a day. I haven't looked at the fine terms and conditions on this from old
Pythagoras.
Sure, if
there's electricity around, touching the earth is the one you want to touch.
Listen, Pythagoras wasn't right on everything, was he? For one, beans, delicious. A little bit of a worst of forward klaxon here. The first source of Pythagoras's belief on transmigration of souls and kindness to animals is from a satire by Xenophanes, who wrote of Pythagoras that once they say he was passing by when a puppy was being whipped. Ding, 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 ding. And took pity and said, "Stop, do not beat it, for it is the soul of a friend that I recognized when I heard it giving tongue."
Hello.
Yep. Barry, please.
I recognise that blowjob.
I recognise that blowjob from a puppy.
Don't kill my favourite puppy. It's really a friend. All right, that's quite a fun... I mean, and numbers and stuff. You know, there's the whole angel numbers trend and magic numbers stuff that we still have these days. So that's...
Just two other wee little things with him that I liked. One is that there was a student of his called Hypasus of Metapontum, who Pythagoras fell out with because Hypasus upset him, particularly with his discovery of irrational numbers, which any mathematician will tell you are a real thing. Things like the square root of minus one, I believe, is an irrational number. And it just made Pythagoras very sad. He was like, no, numbers have order and sense and meaning. Stop messing with my system, yeah. Hypasus. The other thing that I really like about Pythagoras is that it seems both by the standard of the times and the standard of history, very open-minded towards women. Women were welcome into his cult. Now, this was quite a small cult. There were only a few hundred people in it, and it's believed 17 of them were women, including Theano of Croton, who was his wife, and she's considered a major figure in early Pythagoreanism. She's noted as a distinguished philosopher in her own right and even took over the leadership of his school after his death. There's a lot of notions about bringing worthwhile things for a woman. Women, yes, being demure and humble, which obviously is a attribute that is suggested as being good for women throughout history, but also that courage and justice and wisdom are as common to women as they are to men, which I'm going to say pretty progressive for the 5th and 6th century BC.
Aren't you a brave little woman now back in the kitchen?
I mean, broadly speaking, yes, but come on, for the Greeks, that's pretty good.
At the time, yes, pretty good, pretty good.
But for my suggestion, we go to Japan.
Oh.
Now, there are a lot of...
I'm immediately on edge.
Well, correct, because there are a lot of times where you read a cult in Japan and go, good, 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 there's the Kool-Aid. But the PL Kyodan, the Church of Perfect Liberty, which I think we can all agree, alarm bells... seems to be okay. So it is traced back to a Shinto priest called Tokumitsu Kanada, who founded his own sect in 1912. And after his death, his successor, Tokuharu Miki, renamed the sect to Hito no Michi Kyodan, the Way of Man. This group was suppressed by Japanese authorities in 1931 because it was seen as a challenge to the divinity of the emperor. However, after World War II, Tokuharu's grandson re-established the group and gave it the final name, Perfect Liberty. And its teachings can best be summed up in the phrase, and it's its first precept, that life is art. Mm. And members are taught to express themselves artistically in order to leave fulfilling lives. So I will tell you some of the 21 precepts. You have to live is to express oneself. Being annoyed limits your expression. Human beings are all equal. Everything has a way according to its name. There is a way for men and a way for women. All is mirror. All things progress and develop. Begin once you perceive. Live maintaining equilibrium between mind and matter, and live in perfect liberty.
Hmm.
Right?
So far, so good.
So far, so good. There's about a million followers worldwide, 500 churches in 10 countries. They have missionaries who've worked in South America, the States, Brazil, Paraguay, Peru, Oceania, Australia, France, Portugal, Hungary. In 1970, they constructed a 600-foot-tall peace tower as a monument to all people who have died in all war from the beginning of time, which is very much a I'll see you and raise you cenotaph. But my favourite thing, which I think will endear them to you, is because they propagate the notion that all life is art, so something as mundane as office work can be turned into a meditation or religious worship. They have been given the nickname in Japan as the golf religion, because numerous golf rangers have been sanctified by the Kyodan teachings, because even going to the range to practice is a act of worship and supplication.
I am so on board.
There is even, and this is where you have to go, ooh, tinkly little alarm bell. There is even an all-girls dorm at their headquarters where female students work as part-time caddies to support themselves through high school. Now, nothing untoward there, but there's something about it that sounds a little bit,
As they also encourage the male students to do that as well, then I'm fine with it.
Well, precisely.
Just seen that their patriarch has met a couple of popes as well, so...
Yes, he has.
It seems like quite they've got a bit of legitimacy. Any cult who's like, we're all for world peace, as opposed to prepping for the end of the world, that seems a little bit more up my street.
Yeah, so I kind of think mine beats yours on
this one. Yeah, they're not trying to steal my copyright as well. So.
Well, yeah, exactly. I am yet to find any flaws with them, so I think we should take them at their word and go and play a nice round of 18 holes.
Do get
them.
In touch with us, listeners, and tell us all of the horrible news stories we've missed because they were in Japanese. In episode 89, we talked to Jack Bernhardt about the world's worst president, and I believe the victor on that occasion was the victim of a mid-blowjob heart attack. Yes, President Félix François Faure of France, who died. The story goes mid-coitus with his mistress.
Oh my god.
Still one of my favourite stories ever. What did you look at? Presidents, best presidents, hard to nail down a metric for that, I guess.
Yeah, very tricky too. So, first of all, I found a Mexican Emperor Norton.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, we've already picked Emperor Norton as, like, our favourite anything, so...
Yeah. This is a chap called Nicolas Zuniga y Miranda. He was born into a family of old Spanish nobility, but sort of styled himself as a English dandy with a top hat and gloves and a monocle and smoking a pipe. And he gained fame in 1887 when he claimed to have invented a machine that could predict earthquakes. And he successfully predicted an earthquake that struck the capital that year. He then predicted on August the 10th of the same year, Mexico City would be completely leveled via simultaneous eruptions of two different volcanoes. Spoiler alert, it wasn't. Mm. And he then started several magazines predicting natural disasters, including the end of time. And it turns out his first prediction was just lucky, because everything after that did not occur. Now, he lived at the time of Porfirio Diaz, who was the Mexican dictator. He'd ruled the country since 1876, and elections were very much just went through the motions. But Zuniga stood against him in several elections. He barely got more than 1,000 votes, or a few thousand votes each time. He was arrested and sentenced to 25 days of solitary confinement on one occasion. However, after every single election, Zuniga protested against election fraud and declared himself the winner. My favourite moment was when he was released from solitary confinement. He made himself a presidential sash and declared himself the legitimate president and Diaz a usurper.
No, come on. Dude, yep. Let go. That's so sad. That's the pageant queen trying to rip the sash and crown off the real winner.
Well, yeah, but this is the Emperor Norton vibes. He was often invited to parties and other public events where the population treated him as if he was the real president. Thankfully,
now, is this someone Diaz who's got... just like they're being indulged, or is it a little bit like, oh, these are like true MAGA fans of Trump who keep calling him the real president and stuff?
I think he's being indulged because he was sort of seen as a harmless eccentric, and also it feels like a way of being a bit anti-authority and anti-establishment without endangering their lives. So I looked him up, but I went straight for the obvious choice because the hard thing was I wanted to find someone who wasn't American, because the internet, when you go best president, goes, oh, you mean America? And, you know, it's probably Lincoln in it, even though he's ultimately a bit flawed, but it's probably him.
Lincoln.
But it's probably Lincoln, but I didn't go for him. I instead went for Josiah Bartlett.
Yes!
because, now, I had to be careful. For those who don't know, that is the Jed Bartlett is the name of the fictional president played by Martin Sheen in The West Wing. Now, I had to be careful in my research on this because I am a late adopter of The West Wing. I only started watching... An entryist, yes. I only started watching it last year and was only able to get a couple of seasons in before it dropped off all four. So I'm only going off my first 2.5 seasons.
Oh, it gets so good in season 3.
Stop it. I'll be honest, one of my main reasons why I love Jed Bartlett is because as a fictional, nay, at this stage, utopian president, he surrounds himself by good Jews.
Yes.
Like, I quite like Josh Lyman. I adore Toby Ziegler. Not least because my wife is like, he's a grumpy, miserable shithead. I'm like, yes, he's a grumpy, miserable shithead who always does the right thing and fights for progressivism and always thinks the worst is going to happen and is quite delighted when it doesn't. And that's one of my favourite kinds of my people.
He wasn't going to be in it much. It was all going to be about the behind-the-scenes figures, the speechwriters and the press secretary and all of that. And initially they were going to have the president off-screen, and then they were like, okay, well, we need to have a president that'll be like a major figure, but they'll only like appear in 3 or 4 episodes in a season maybe, peripheral figure. And I think it was going to be Sidney Poitier was one of the people they initially...
Sidney Poitier, that would have been the... I'm not sure the times that might have been the first black president because Dennis Haybert, I think, was the first black president in 24. But yeah, God, Poitier would have been incredible. There was him, Alan Alda, and a chap called Jason Robards, who I don't really know about.
Much of a spoiler to say that Alan Alda appears as a presidential candidate later on in the seasons that you haven't gotten to yet, Ben, which is quite great. So he does appear.
Yes.
Which is great. But Martin Sheen, once you've seen Martin Sheen as it, you can't think of anyone else doing it. It's great.
No, he's absolutely remarkable.
He gets the great opening line as well of a character.
Oh, so I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other but me.
Boy, those are the days, huh? It's what he adds to the end of it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we talked before about Tom Stoppard, but what an amazing thing to go. There's the character summed up in one line. And it's the way they build up to it. It's just the perfect back and forth between... the evangelist Christians and the good Jews he surrounded himself by, and he turns up as both God and King Solomon all in one. It's just wonderful.
He also has a great wife. He's married to Stockard Channing in it. Abby Bartlett.
Yeah, again, which is like, I don't know if Stockard Channing was in anything else other than Grease, but it took me a while to wrap my head around her being in this as well as being...
Rizzo.
I've forgotten that. Rizzo, thank you. Is she in anything else?
Oh, she's been in loads of stuff. She won an Academy Award for 6 Degrees of Separation.
Right.
Yes, the Kevin Bacon story. She's won Tony Awards other things, Emmys, and yeah, she's brilliant. Yeah.
Great, fine. And she's incredible as the rat in Muppets as well.
You've got to watch the whole thing. I think it's back online somewhere. I saw recently. I think it might be on Netflix now or somewhere. It's floating around, or maybe even Disney on Disney Plus. But it is just hands down. I mean, occasionally slightly, you know, late 90s, early noughties, men talking to women bits in it. But in terms of wishing for a better type of politics and all that stuff, because a lot of the advisors on the show worked in politics or speak, like Lawrence O'Donnell, who worked for Clinton, was a writer on it, and he hosts a show, a news show on American TV now. And it's a lot of insightful people. Ron Klain.
It is. And it's, I mean, obviously, both in our country and America, essentially the political choices between probably well-meaning but not progressive enough and ultimately quite hollow, and in this country not nearly charismatic enough, or the actual proper fucking baddies. Yeah. But It's good to see this as idealistic politics, but it costs them stuff, and it's difficult, and they do get things wrong.
That's the great thing is not everything neatly is solved, and it's not like each episode is this is a problem and it's going to be solved by the president. There's a lot of stuff he wants to have done and doesn't get done in it, and a lot of things that fail.
He's not House. I mean, House is obviously flawed, but ultimately House most of the time comes up with the answer, and he doesn't every time, and that's great. Two last little words on him. The description of him, it's unsurprising to know that Sorkin drew a lot on Bill Clinton. Mike McCurry, a former press secretary from that administration, described Bartlet as the ideal president, possessing the compassion and integrity of Jimmy Carter, the shrewd decision-making and hard-nosed realism of a Nixon, the warmth and amiability of Bill Clinton, and the liberal passion of Teddy Kennedy. Another gentleman, James Ponivozik, who was an American journalist and television critic, was a little bit more cutting when he described the character as a folksy Nobel laureate with touches of FDR, Stephen Hawking, Will Rogers, and the Buddha. And did you know that Bartlet almost made a return to TV in a different series?
Oh, no, I didn't.
He was at the very end of... Now, I don't know whether it was the TV series or the movie, but in the final scene where everything was revealed to Fox Mulder, he was going to appear in the X-Factor, Jesus Christ. In the... he was going
Jed
to appear
Bartlett.
In the... he was going to appear in the X-Files as the president, but instead they got a cipher for George W. Bush.
Very good. I like the fact that if you do watch The West Wing, basically real American history has happened up to Nixon. And they don't mention presidents after Nixon, basically. They've got fictional presidents.
Oh, they don't mention Reagan.
They mention fictional presidents beyond Nixon. You can find a sort of a little timeline of it online if you want to. But that's the cutoff point in history in terms of presidents they feel they need to be able to mention because they're talking about American politics and history and stuff like that. A very good choice, and obviously the one I'm going to pick. I mean, it's hard to go past Nelson Mandela, isn't it, as a good president, a real-life president.
Him.
President of South Africa after apartheid. Mary Robinson, who's the former president of Ireland, who's went on to be the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and a very good, noble world figure. Ireland has 7-year terms, so you get quite lengthy presidential terms if you get it. You're limited to 2 terms, but 2 terms is 14 years, which is a long time, because the president in Ireland isn't an executive office in the same way as it is in America or France. Is much less power. They're much more of a figurehead in the manner of the King of England. But I decided my metric would be length of time served. So at one end, you have the Mexican Pedro Lascurain, who was the 34th president of Mexico for a time between 15 and 56 minutes in 1913.
Tremendous.
I think he'd been the former foreign minister at a couple of times. He quit in a coup d'etat to make General Victoriano Huerta the president. But at the other end of the scale, you've got President Malietoa Tanumafili II, who held the office of Ola Ao o le Malo, which is basically the president of Samoa, for 45 years and 130 days. It was...
Wow.
They created it as a special lifetime term. It was going to be a term length of 5 years, and they gave him 45 years. It was a joint job initially alongside Tupua Tamese Mealoe from 1962 to 63, and then he was the sole head of state from 1963 until his death. From what I can tell, it's essentially the president of a republic, this role. But the way that Samoa seems to work is you have these 4 paramount chiefs of various tribes, and the president is selected from among them, basically. So he was also simultaneously one of these chiefs. He was credited with providing a lot of stability. Samoa was relatively peaceful after their independence. And there was a very massive, big choreographed state funeral on his death as well. And so I think, as much as he might try, I don't know that Putin will get to 45 years as a president of anywhere.
One would hope not.
He had a break to be prime minister for 4 years as well, if I remember rightly. So I just went for sheer length of time served. You know, FDR did, what was it, 12 years? Something like that.
He was scheduled for 16, yes. But he checked out after World War II.
Early on in season four.
hell of a decision by the writers.
But I don't think either the Scorain, who checked out very early, or Melitoa Tanumafili, who stuck it in for 45 years, can hold a torch to Jed Bartlett. He was going to be my choice too. So well done, both of us.
I'm glad that we went for the answer staring right in front of us.
Sometimes, guys, the show isn't subjective. Sometimes there's an objectively correct answer. Finally, in episode 90, we talked about the world's worst fan fiction with Andrew Schaffer, and we picked my choice that day, which was The Adventure of Two Collaborators. It was a pastiche of Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories, which we mentioned earlier on, by J.M. Barrie, who had just worked with Doyle on a light opera, I think, together. And in it, Conan Doyle fights Holmes, who dies slightly less dramatically than at the end of the final problem. He dies with the line, "Henceforth you shall ride on buses."
Sorry, just because it's been a while. Conan Doyle fights
Holmes.
Yeah,
it's a weird self-referential parody where the two authors go and meet Holmes and Watson, and there's a bit of a falling out over Doyle is using Holmes's image to make money for himself, so Holmes decides to fight his own creator, and it's weird. That's what any wonder we chose it as the world's worst fan fiction.
Yeah.
I read a little bit about D'Artagnan, the real D'Artagnan. D'Artagnan is not a fictional character. D'Artagnan was a real person.
No, he's a muskerhound.
Yes, D'Artagnan of muskerhounds and musketeer fame. Charles de Bat de Castlemore, who was known as D'Artagnan or Count D'Artagnan, lived from about 1611 to 1673. And he served Louis XIV as captain of the musketeers of the guard. And he was born in the southwest of France, and his father was the son of a newly ennobled merchant. So they were sort of new money, nouveau riche people. And Charles went to Paris in the 1630s, and he took his mother's name, Françoise de Montesquieu d'Artagnan. And using the name, it sounds a bit posher, doesn't it? D'Artagnan, as opposed to Castlemore. And he joined the musketeers, and probably by pulling some family strings or a family friend helped get him in. There's a little bit of nepotism involved. But he had a very exalted career. As I said, that was in the 30s, and he was there for the next 40 years. He'd involved in espionage. He helped with the arrest of Nicolas Fouquet, who was embezzling from the king. Fouquet threw a party and gave everyone present a horse, and apparently this made the king go, "Where are you getting all this money from?" And that was how he was found out. D'Artagnan was so trusted as someone who wouldn't be bribed and would be very diligent that he was the one who was given the job of guarding Fouquet for 4 years before his sentence was passed. And he was, I think, governor of the region of Lille for a while. And then he died in battle at the siege of Maastricht. So, you know, a soldier's death and all of that. And obviously, he was famously, his life and adventures were immortalized in the work by...
My brain is saying Marcel Marceau, and that could not be more wrong if it tried, but it's actually Alexander Dumas.
It is and it isn't, because Dumas read an earlier book. Let me introduce you to Gatien de Courtis de Sandras, who was a French novelist and journalist. And he wrote loads of short stories and letters, and he wrote historical love stories and all this sort of stuff. And he wrote semi-fictional memoirs. That was a thing that he particularly specialised in. And he wrote The Memoirs de Monsieur D'Artagnan in 1700. And he wrote them as, you know, first person, autobiographical works. And they describe the world of Richelieu and Mazarin, and they're very realistic. But there's lots of, you know, spies and kidnappings and exciting, derring-do stuff. And his memoirs of D'Artagnan were very sensational, because D'Artagnan, as you can see from his biography, was a famed character, famed legendary figure in 17th century France. And Cortés de Sandras had been in the army, and so he knew a bit about that world. So there's a lot of realistic details in it. And he'd been imprisoned in the Bastille a couple of times. And the warden of the Bastille was a chap called Baisemeaux, who was a companion of D'Artagnan's and will have known a lot of intimate details of D'Artagnan's life as well. So de Sandras had insider, second-hand knowledge of D'Artagnan. And Dumas, Alexandre Dumas Père, who did write the Three Musketeers and a couple of other D'Artagnan books, he got a copy of Sandras's memoirs from a library and was so entranced by them and excited by them that he never returned it to the library. And he knew that it was very fictionalized. He was a writer. He knew what Sandras was doing. But in the preface to The Three Musketeers, he also makes it out that the memoirs are real to make his own novel more believable. And, you know, in the book, D'Artagnan is a hothead and he tries to fight the Comte de Rochefort and Athos, Porthos and Aramis in combat, and then he becomes friends with them and they have loads of adventures and they're at odds with Richelieu, and then eventually Richelieu makes him the lieutenant of the musketeers, and then the sequels depict his long military career and so on. But all of that is spawned from a fan fiction work, if you like, where Dumas has read this fictional or semi-fictional autobiographical work by Sandras and gone, that's where my novel's going to come from. And Sandras is writing sort of fanboy works about this famous French hero in the first place. And obviously The Three Musketeers has become one of the most famous literary works and most recreated and celebrated on screen and on radio and on stage and so on. So I think as far as good fan fiction goes, I think it's a pretty decent choice.
That's a very solid.
There's a lot of literary heft to that fan fiction.
Yes, I would very much agree with that. Before we go to my choice, I discovered something remarkable. Now, fan fiction in my head, I think correctly, sits in the same sort of world as Comic-Con and things like that, doesn't it? Because it's often written as a homage. Some people give homage to their beloved works via cosplaying and others by writing. And I discovered basically the world's first Comic-Con, which happened over 130 years ago at the Royal Albert Hall. And it was known as the Vril-Yar Bazaar and Fete. And it was a charity fundraiser that was inspired by a pretty eccentric piece of sci-fi writing by a chap called Edward Bulwer Lytton called Vril, The Power of the Coming Race. It was a story written in 1871, told the discovery of a superhuman race with advanced powers of healing, intellect, telepathy, and even flight that lived below the Earth's surface. And you might be thinking, what's that? A mid to late Victorian piece of fiction that seems a bit eugenics-y? Surely not. The word Vril, which in the novel it means a special fluid that enhances the superhuman powers, became synonymous in late Victorian England with energy-boosting elixirs. And there was a chap called Dr. Herbert Tibbets who founded an institution that is so late Victorian, I love it, the West End Hospital and School of Massage and Electricity.
Sure, and why not?
Yeah.
There's lots of people rubbing their hands together and or like on woolly surfaces.
Yes. Yeah, getting the balloons there to behave was impossible. Yeah. But he thought that Vril would be a good theme for a fundraising fete. And so it was announced on March 5th, 1891. Prince Henry and Princess Beatrice of Battenberg officially opened the bazaar, and it accepted donations on behalf of the West End Hospital. Members of the public paid 5 shillings to £1 and 1 shilling to enter, and in the main hall there was architecture of the underground world, evocative of ancient Egypt. There was an aerial display of mannequins meant to evoke the people of Vril. People dressed up to get in the spirit. There, people wore wings or ancient Greek or Egyptian garb. There was magic shows, dramatic readings, a guitar band, organ recitals. indoor fishing, palmistry, a demon dog said to read minds, and my favourite thing of all, do you know, can you work out, based on the fact that this land and the people are called Vril, which famous drink slash food stuff sponsored the event and had its had itself on offer for patrons?
It's got to be Bovril, doesn't it?
It was Bovril. It was Bovril. There was small glasses of Bovril were put on sale there.
Like a yeast extract. It's a meat extract, isn't it, rather than yeast extract?
No, it's a meat extract, yes. It's weirdly, it's sold in similar jars to Marmite, but it's very, very different. The event was actually extended for 3 extra days, not because of its popularity, but because it lost so much money, Tibbetts had to try and attempt to recoup his losses. However, 3 months after the show wrapped, he declared bankruptcy, having lost £1,600.
Oh, no.
I know. So feels very on brand for our podcast. But I didn't really know where to look for the best fanfic. And I found a little blog post of someone asking Neil Gaiman what he thinks of fanfiction. Do you think it's useful for honing writing skills? And he said, listen, I don't read it, but he thinks that all writing is useful for honing your writing skills. He's very much a one word in front of another kind of a guy. Yeah. And I talk about this with stand-up. When you start as a stand-up, you're basically doing, you're cosplaying as your favourite stand-up, and you slowly but surely edit them away and become more yourself. And Gaiman in this blog post said he sees fan fiction as training wheels. Sooner or later, you take them off the bike and start wobbling down the street on your own.
Nice. That's a nice way of doing.
However, it's a lovely metaphor, isn't it? He has written a short story that won the Hugo Award in 2004 for Best Short Story. And it is called A Study in Emerald.
Yes.
Which is basically Sherlock Holmes fan fiction if Sherlock Holmes lived in the same universe as all of H.P. Lovecraft's hideous creations, Elder Gods, and the Cthulhu mythos.
No.
Have you read this, Barry? It's genuinely brilliant.
Okay.
I mean, of course it is. It's Neil Gaiman. It's the first story in his collection, Fragile Things. And I'm going to try and avoid telling you the twist. So I'll just sort of tell you the opening of it. There is an unnamed narrator, a veteran of a bloody war against the gods and men of Afghanistan, seeks lodgings upon his return to Albion. Early in his acquaintance, he meets Inspector Lestrade of Scotland Yard, who hopes to hire him in a matter of national importance alongside his roommate. And what they are investigating is the murder of someone of German royal blood, and they can tell that because they have an inhuman number of limbs. And Lestrade confirms this, his identity as a guest and nephew of the Queen of Albion. And they are taken to the palace to see the Queen. The Queen, of course, is one of the great old ones who defeated humanity 700 years ago and now rules the world. And the next scene, they go to a musical show where the show on that evening is a historical narrative depicting the war between humanity and the great old ones. And I don't want to tell you anymore because I want you and all of our listeners to go and read this study in Emerald. But it is the best mashing up of two literary traditions I have encountered by obviously one of my favourite authors, and I think one of the best authors in the world today. It's just phenomenal. It's only about 20, 30 pages long, and it's satisfying as a mashup, and it's satisfying in its own right.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, nice. I also considered mentioning D&D, Dungeons and Dragons, because that's obviously a fan fiction putting together, you know, basically. It's basically Tolkien fan fiction. Turned into a game and has become its own thing.
Yes, of course.
It sort of fits what Neil Gaiman would say. It sort of spawns its own fan fiction in lots of ways, D&D, by allowing people to exercise their storytelling abilities and role play and provides escapism. So, and I think there's a lot of bad around D&D, but there's a lot of good stuff that's come out of D&D as well.
There is. Well, we've mentioned Joel already on the show. Joel's wonderful new podcast, Comfort Blanket, where he gets someone onto the show to talk about a book or a film or a piece of music that may not be the best thing, but it is their comfort blanket. It brings them comfort and joy and security, and he investigates why that is. And he had a guest on who talked about the Dungeons & Dragons book, and it's remarkable. Dungeons and Dragons ability to essentially allow anyone, even if they have no confidence or performance skill, to become a free-form immersive improviser.
Yeah. And it does cater to lots of different play styles as well. You can be very free with it. Johnny Chiodini, who's been on our show, they DM a lot, and they like to have a very loose, very story, you know, playful driven thing. But there's lots of rules to Dungeons and Dragons if you want to play with all the rules and with maps and you know, very, very defined limits on what people can and can't do. You can do that as well. It caters to all ranges of approaches, which I think is a really useful thing. It can feel overwhelming to enter into it, but if you decide what way you want to play it and you find like-minded people to do it, the tools are there in the sandbox.
Yeah, precisely so. Have we basically dismissed each other's suggestions in favour of D&D in its entirety?
Let's come to an entente cordiale at the end of that and decide that we actually both of us quite like D&D in role-playing games. lovely.
Yep, agreed.
Thank you, everybody, as ever, for listening to Worst Foot Forward. We hope you enjoyed this intermittent burst of positivity. Don't worry, we will be back in a couple of weeks with a regularly negative episode. If you want to keep in touch with us between now and then, as ever, get on board on Twitter on @WorstFoot or on Instagram or on @WorstFoot as well. Hop in the Discord. I dipped back into Discord there last week. The link is in the description to the episode. There's lots of other Worst Foot Forward fans chatting and sharing images of cats and favorite facts and stuff like that. And get on Patreon. Patreon.com/WorstFootForward if you feel like you can spare a few quid for us, because aside from monthly silly attempts to break world records and extra content from episodes which doesn't make the edit and other bits and pieces like extracts from our upcoming book, we've a couple of live shows in the offing next year. Not allowed to say when and where yet, but we'll be announcing them shortly, and you'll get first heads up on those and on guest announcements and all sorts of stuff like that.
Yes, exactly so. We are hoping in the run-up to our book coming out that next year is going to be the year of many live shows and festivals, and indeed the same in 2024. And we'll be bringing, we hope, some pretty hefty guests to them, and we will make sure that you get some cheeky behind-the-scenes content for that on Patreon. So if you want to get in early for that, do join us over there. But yes, thank you for listening, and we hope we have brightened your day with some good news. Back in a fortnight with the worst of everything.